It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. I'm Phil Picardi. It's Thursday, October 4. Today we hear about the increasingly bitter congressional race in northeastern Minnesota. Another victim of last week's mass shooting in Minneapolis is laid to rest. And with all the bad weather, the late frost, extreme dry, the heat, it's not a bad harvest for farmers overall. Snow and rain helping to tamp down wildfires in northwestern Minnesota. Several inches of snow possible by tomorrow. Fires burning in the northwest have scorched more than 30,000 acres and more than a dozen homes this week. State Fire Information Officer Gil Knight says some areas have been damaged more than others.
Fire does not burn everything. It burns in a mosaic pattern. Within these acres, there may be islands of unburned fuel, or there may be areas where there was a nice little ground fire that went through and burned up the pine needles and the small twigs and that kind of thing. And then, of course, there will probably be areas where it looks like the surface of the moon, too, where it burned much hotter.
The largest blaze is the North Mini Fire, burning west of Red Lake. Some of the most difficult to fight fires are burning in peat bogs, where decaying vegetation could smolder for months. The mother of a Minneapolis college student killed in Somalia while fighting for al-Shabaab says her son wouldn't have been able to survive in that African country without help. Her testimony came yesterday during the trial of a man accused of helping send young men from the Twin Cities to Somalia. Laura Ewan is covering the trial.
Abeta Ahmed told a federal jury that her 19-year-old son, Jamal Sheikh Bana, disappeared in December 2008. She said he worked part-time as a security guard but didn't have the resources to buy a $1,000 plane ticket to Somalia. The following year, his parents learned over the internet that Bana was killed. In the courtroom, Bana's mother cried and jerked her head away when the prosecutor showed her bloody pictures of her son's body. The government says the man on trial, Mahmoud Saeed Omar, brought Bana and five other young Minneapolis men to a travel agency to get their plane tickets to Somalia. But Omar's attorneys maintain his innocence. They say he was not helping al-Shabaab, which the U.S. considers a terrorist organization.
Laura Ewan there. Stephanie Hempel is next. She's got a report on the competing documents filed with the Minnesota Court of Appeals. They're from the DNR and two conservation groups sparring over the state's November wolf hunt.
The DNR says the appeals court does not have the authority to stop the hunt. The agency says it followed proper procedure in planning the hunt and gathering public opinion through an online survey. The Center for Biological Diversity and Howling for Wolves counter that an online survey is not the same as giving the public a chance to comment in writing and offer data to support arguments. They're asking the court to halt the hunt while it considers their arguments. The wolf hunt is scheduled to begin November 3rd. There's no indication when the court will rule. Stephanie Hempel, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Another funeral was held yesterday for one of the victims of last week's shooting at Accent Signage in Minneapolis. Elizabeth Dunbar reports Jacob Beneke was the youngest of the five people killed by a terminated employee.
Jacob Beneke was only 34 years old, but his friends say he was well on his way to reaching his dreams. He'd been married to his wife Ileana for 9 years, and their son Radomir just turned 6. Beneke loved gardening at their home in Maple Grove. He was happy with his work as a graphic designer and hoped his own graphic design company would become a full-time job someday. Alan McQuaid is a close friend.
He really found happiness. He found his path. He was on that path, and it's tragic that it was cut short, but he was able to experience some of that happiness before he was taken.
McQuaid and Beneke shared an apartment with three other friends at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. McQuaid says Beneke was the one to keep everyone in line and make sure the bills were paid. When the friends went their separate ways after college, McQuaid says Beneke wasn't about to lose touch with people.
There's something that you hold dear and you fight to keep it alive. You fight to, you know, keep connections with people. Really value his friends.
Beneke grew up in northeastern Iowa in the town of New Albin. Tony Love had known Beneke since first grade and was best man at his wedding in 2003.
He had this calming effect on everybody whenever you'd hang out with him, and he was always a guy that was just, you know, the gentle giant. You know, a guy was like 6'1", 6'2", was a bigger guy, and he was just, you know, he just had that effect on people, and you couldn't help but be a little happier when you're around the guy.
After college, Beneke worked as a cook at a resort in Lutzen, Minnesota, where he met his future wife, who's from Bulgaria. The two traveled to an art center near Florence, Italy, for 2 summers as Beneke studied with brother Jerome Cox. Cox says he learned fast.
I say he was very talented, and he was also doing sculpture. All my students learn how to do jewelry work and sculpture, and mechanics, and electricity, and laying cement, and a lot of other things. So he was very talented, very hard worker, and very humorous. Very nice person to be with.
One of Jake Beneke's sculptures is on display at the Maple Grove Arts Center. It's a rabbit made of recycled materials, wood, a chainsaw motor, and a Heineken beer bottle cap for a nose. Other sculptures have featured old gas cans and bicycle wheels. On his website, Beneke described his art as, quote, the birth of society's rejects, and he wrote that he sees the infinity of all materials, even human life. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minnesota Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann says the recent anti-American violence in the Middle East proves comments she made about the Muslim Brotherhood's influence in the U.S. government are accurate. Conrad Wilson chatted with Bachmann yesterday.
After a campaign event in St. Cloud, Bachmann reaffirmed her concerns about the Muslim Brotherhood's influence on the U.S. government, calling it a violent organization.
We've seen the violent actions that have occurred not only in Cairo and Libya, but also around the world at various embassies. So I think I've been proven right.
So you think those concerns are still legitimate today?
Of course.
Over the summer, Bachmann faced criticism from both Democrats and members of her own party over claims she made about the Muslim Brotherhood's influence on the federal government.
Wilson in the 6th, now Mark Zedeklik in the 8th. Republican Chip Cravack and Democrat Rick Nolan are battling over Medicare in their congressional race, the 8th District. Both have aired new TV ads on the subject this week.
Chip Cravack started the Medicare campaign TV ad war earlier this week with a spot criticizing Rick Nolan for supporting a proposal to cut the growth in Medicare spending by nearly $750 million.
I'm Chip Cravack. My opponent believes cutting $700 billion from Medicare won't have an impact on seniors. I disagree. I approve this message because Medicare is a commitment we made to our parents. It's a promise I plan to keep.
The problem with Cravack's dramatic ad is he voted twice for Republican Representative Paul Ryan's budget plan, which included the same level of cuts in the growth of Medicare spending. Nolan responded with his own ad, accusing Cravack of running a desperate campaign.
The truth. Cravack's radical budget would undermine Medicare. Cravack voted to essentially end it, raising costs over $6,000 a year. Rick Nolan has a better way.
Medicare is a big deal because about 10,000 baby boomers are expected to retire every day for the next 20 years or so. That means enrollment in Medicare will nearly double, as will the cost, and there will be fewer people working to support those getting the benefits. The GOP Medicare plan Cravack supports would apply only to people who are 55 and younger today. Medicare would remain unchanged for Americans currently in the program or quickly approaching it. Under the plan, private health insurers would bid on the cost of providing a baseline of care. The second least expensive bid would set the price for a voucher that the government would give to people to buy their health care plan. Among the options would be a plan Ryan and other supporters say would be like traditional Medicare. But if in the bidding the Medicare option came in more expensive than the second least expensive plan, people who want to stick with Medicare would have to pay extra. The first Ryan proposal didn't include a Medicare-administered plan. The Congressional Budget Office determined that first plan would have cost future seniors $6,400 more a year than they otherwise would pay. Harvard University professor David Cutler, who's consulted with the Obama administration and campaign, analyzed Ryan's most recent proposal that includes the Medicare option. Cutler says it would cost future seniors even more than the first Ryan plan, about $6,800 more a year. So Cutler says Democrats like Nolan are correct in claiming that the GOP plan would end up costing future Medicare recipients a lot more money.
The Ryan proposal gives seniors a voucher that's expected to be significantly less than what Medicare costs. And the voucher increases at a significantly lower rate than what medical costs are expected to increase by. So the net effect is that it has to cost people more. It's just shifting cost to people. And the only question is how much that is.
But University of Minnesota professor Roger Feldman says the competition among health insurance companies at the heart of the Ryan Plan stands to drive down costs. And Feldman, who specializes in health economics, says what Republicans are proposing for Medicare is remarkably similar to the direction Democrats went for the rest of the population with the Affordable Care Act. Obamacare, as many call it, sets a price for the cost of a defined health care plan through an almost identical competitive bidding process.
The Affordable Care Act uses exchanges and bidding for the under 65 group. Republicans say they hate it. The Romney-Ryan plan, I'll use your words, proposes the same thing for the over 65 group. The president says he hates it. Now, if they could both drop half of what they're saying and get together, we would have competitive bidding for the whole population.
Feldman does not like the term voucher and instead says premium support is a more accurate way to characterize the proposed government payment to individuals to help them buy insurance. Kravac doesn't like the voucher term either. Henry Aaron of the Brookings Institution helped coin the phrase premium support to counter negative connotations associated with the term voucher when Bill Clinton was president.
Back in 1996, there were a lot of voucher proposals floating around, and they were getting a bad name.
Aaron says what's proposed in the Ryan Plan is absolutely a voucher because the increase in the payment for insurance would be tied to the growth of the U.S. economy, not to the cost of health care.
In this case, premium support is a voucher plan with certain bells and whistles.
Kravac says he's not worried Democrats will be able to scare voters into thinking he and other Republicans want to dismantle Medicare with what he insists is a premium support plan.
I'm looking forward to the debates, and I'm looking forward to discussing the issues about Medicare.
Kravac says at least Republicans are proposing something to address future Medicare insolvency. And like Feldman from the U of M, Kravac notes this isn't the first time such a proposal has come up.
We have a plan that saves Medicare, and it's a very viable plan. And again, this plan comes from Alice Rivlin under the Clinton administration. I mean, this is actually a Democratic plan. You know, how come they were for it then, but they're not for it now?
But Nolan and many other Democrats say converting Medicare into a voucher system would be a boon for the insurance industry at the expense of seniors.
Chip Kravac would turn Medicare over to the insurance industry, and I oppose that.
Nolan points to Medicare's low administrative costs relative to what private insurers spend on overhead.
It costs roughly 3 or 4% to administer Medicare. Private sector insurance on average runs somewhere between 27 and 30% administrative costs. So once you turn Medicare back over to the insurance industry, you know, right out of the chute, you're dramatically increasing the administrative costs.
While it's clear private insurance companies spend much more on overhead than Medicare, analysts say it's difficult to determine exactly how much more. Nolan and Kravac meet for their first debate next week in Duluth. If their ad campaigns are an indication of what's to come, expect a vigorous discussion of the GOP Medicare voucher plan and whether Democrats have any alternative to address the explosive growth and cost of Medicare.
That's Mark Zedeklik. Our man down on the farm is Mark Stile. He says Minnesota's crop season started and ended in drought this year, but in between, things weren't too bad for most farmers.
Last April, more than 99% of Minnesota was either abnormally dry or in drought. By midsummer, that percentage had fallen to the mid-30s as rains moved in. But then the drought returned. Now, three-quarters of the state is in drought, and the rest is abnormally dry. But driving along a gravel road in his pickup truck near the town of Franklin in southern Minnesota, farmer Brian Greenslit isn't complaining. He says the late summer dry down actually had a positive side. It helped him get an early start on picking his crops.
Harvest is moving along at a record pace.
Greenslit and his neighbor work together on the harvest, sharing equipment and workers. On this day, the crew is in one of the neighbor's soybean fields.
Here's the trucks lined up. These are all waiting to get loaded to go to town.
Greenslit says he may finish the fall harvest in the next week or so. He's rarely even half done that early. He says overall his crop is decent considering what his fields went through. Heavy rains in May and June delivered just enough moisture to keep the crop going through the parching late summer. But the skies delivered some damage as well. Greenslet expects his corn crop to come in at about 150 bushels an acre, well below average for this part of the state.
Well, that particular field we just went by, it had a real devastating hailstorm in June, so it only did about 150. You know you had 200 bushel corn out there, and to be bringing 150 back to the farm is a little disappointing.
But Greenslet says his crop insurance should cover most of the hail damage. Statewide, for the second straight year, drought shrank the Minnesota corn harvest. The current federal estimate of 156 bushels an acre would be about 10% below normal. Those lost bushels are worth about $900 million. But state farmers are still doing much better than the rest of the nation. Minnesota's 156 bushels is 27% better than the national average. And with corn prices high, most state farmers should make a healthy profit. But the drought could still deal out some punishment, even though the growing season is over.
Well, the one that we're in particular concerned about here is that fungus called Aspergillus.
University of Minnesota plant pathologist Dean Melvick says Aspergillus can produce aflatoxin, a substance potentially fatal to livestock and a possible cause of cancer in humans. He says when moisture is in short supply, the corn plant has a harder time keeping the fungus at bay.
When it's under stress, it's more susceptible to the kind of infection and the type of toxin production that we're talking about.
Melvick says so far he hasn't heard of any confirmed aflatoxin cases in state cornfields, but says concerned farmers should test their grain. If the corn contains too much aflatoxin, it can't be sold. For most farmers, though, the harvest should be a relatively enjoyable time. Despite the ongoing drought, many are seeing better yields than expected. Retired corn seed scientist Forrest Troyer says the main reason for that is because today's corn plant withstands dry weather better than past varieties. He says unlike past droughts, relatively few corn stalks this year failed to develop an ear.
A small ear yields more than no ear at all, so I mean it was definitely contributing to better yields than they would have gotten otherwise.
Troyer says during a walk through some drought-damaged Illinois cornfields, only 5% or so of the corn stalks he saw were barren. He says in past droughts, as many as 30% of the plants failed to produce an ear. Troyer says new varieties grow better root systems that are able to soak up even minute amounts of soil moisture. The advancement may be valuable again next summer, should the drought extend into a third straight growing season.
That's Mark Stile in Renville County. I'm Phil Picardi here in St. Paul at Minnesota Public Radio News. Thanks for tuning to the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. I'll be back to wrap the week tomorrow with the Friday edition of the podcast.